Building Bridges to listeners over WPFW 89.3 FM DC, WBAI 99.5 FM New York, and over radio and internet stations across the country. Later on, the gender pay gap. It's all too real and actually expected to widen as women continue to return to work. And the consequences, well, they are quite simply enormous and frightening.
But first, 9 employees at the Mexican Ford assembly plant were shot by a group of drunken thugs and gangsters. Well, finally, Building Bridges guest Rob McKenzie is about to reveal the role of the AFL-CIO's involvement in U.S. foreign policy and its support of U.S. imperialism through undermining legitimate labor unions in the global South that fuel the attack.
Investigative journalist, author, labor activist Rob McKenzie is about to lay bare the sordid facts of El Golpe, the coup, U.S. labor, the CIA, and the coup at Ford in Mexico. Rob, first of all, it's good to have you with us.
Well, thanks for having me on this evening. I appreciate it.
Rob, what brought you to unearthing the harrowing story that you tell in your book, U.S. Labor, the CIA, the coup at Ford in Mexico? Tell us about your work, and really the story that you tell, I have to say, is done with such pathos and intelligence. The story of the collaboration, the cooperation between the U.S. most prominent labor federation and the CIA to devastate progressive workers' movements. So what brought you to that investigation?
I was working at a Ford assembly plant in St. Paul, Minnesota in 1990, and our local union heard about an attack that took place inside a Ford assembly plant near Mexico City. And these workers were involved in a dissident movement, and several hundred thugs came into the plant, engaged them in a fight, opened fire, and 10 were wounded, one eventually died. And our local union and several others around the country did support work for this dissident group, which is called the Ford Workers Democratic Movement. Now, you know, they were up against a tremendous number of opponents and powerful forces, which we really didn't even understand at the time. But in 1996, I was at a meeting of the Coalition for Justice and the Maquiladoras. And at the conclusion of that two-day meeting, a staff person for the newly elected president of the AFL-CIO, John Sweeney, came up to me and said they had believed that the American Institute for Free Labor Development had been involved in that and those events at Cuautitlan Ford. And I said, well, they're related to the CIA, right? And he goes, yes, we are, and we're trying to find out what happened. Well, I tried to pursue that at the time, and I got nowhere. I got doors slammed in my face. And I heard whispers about this other places over the years. And when I was retiring, a local historian kind of challenged me, why didn't you ever follow that up? And when I retired, I decided, well, I'm going to research this. I have the connections. I have the time. I'm going to look into what happened here. And it was turned into a five-year journey. And I found out a lot of things about what happened and a lot of things about the CIA involvement in the AFL-CIO.
Rob McKenzie, let's open the pages of the sordid tale you tell in El Golpe, U.S. Labor, the CIA, the Ford coup in Mexico, with you reading a passage from your book.
Okay. I'm going to read a passage. It's from the chapter called The Coup, and it's really about what happened in that fateful day in January of 1990. I'll use the term golpeadores, which is a Spanish word, and it doesn't really translate that well into English. It kind of means thugs who were involved in a coup, is how I would translate that. The activists reported for work on January 8th, expecting trouble. When reporting for work at the beginning of a shift, workers in a Ford assembly plant first go to a small coverall locker to retrieve a clean pair of coveralls. That morning, 10 leaders of the January 5th work stoppage found that the locks on these lockers had been changed, preventing them from getting coveralls. A notice was posted on each of their lockers telling them to report to the locksmith to be assigned new ones. When they approached the locksmith, they could see unusual characters loitering in the area. All but one of them decided to go directly to their workstations. That unfortunate worker was beaten. When the rest of the workforce arrived for the morning shift on January 8th, they found 300 strangers on the assembly lines. These were easily identifiable as not being genuine Ford employees because they wore tennis shoes instead of the required leather shoes, and they were wearing Ford ID badges around their necks. Ford employees would keep them in their pockets so they wouldn't get caught on things, come loose, and be lost. Many of the golpeadores were drunk or on drugs. The intruders immediately started to harass and intimidate the workers. The leaders had prepared for this event, and the workers picked up tools and organized themselves to fight back. The workers knew the plant and outmaneuvered the golpeadores, who felt cornered, took out their guns, and opened fire. A voice came over the company loudspeaker, telling the workers to do as they were told. Escobar Briones remembers the voice in the loudspeaker saying, "Do not run. Those are only blanks." 9 workers would go down wounded, one of them fatally.
Wow. And after reading that, you thoroughly had me hooked. And I plowed through the book deeply and consistently and want everybody else who is concerned about the issues of covert activity, about subversion, and who understand that it is workers who create the wealth of a society and indeed the working class that can bring us to a new world that is egalitarian and just. And so that has everything to do with this story of what? There are people deliberately sent in, golpeadores, to subvert labor organizing under horrific conditions that exist for workers in Mexico. I mean, continue with the story. What the heck is going on? What is this group, Afield? And why would any U.S. labor entity or federation be supporting reactionary policies that are responsible for killing workers organizing and organizing in Mexico?
I think I'll just give a little background about what was going on in Mexico, because it really started to make sense to me when I saw this just wasn't a strange one-off event, but it was really tied to the economics and the political situation in Mexico. I mean, you had Ronald Reagan, who was waging an offensive against Nicaragua, El Salvador, leftists and insurgents, and that was based a lot on their feeling that Mexico was vulnerable to revolution or destabilizing events. In 1988, there was a Mexican presidential candidate, Cuauhtemoc Cárdenas, who split from the Revolutionary Institutional Party, who'd been ruling Mexico for 65 years, and formed a coalition that included socialists and communists, and probably won that election. There was massive fraud. Only 45% of the votes got counted. The military seized the ballot boxes, and several years later, those were burned. So in this situation, the CIA became very active in Mexico in the late 1980s. And they were very concerned about labor organizing and the working class in Mexico. So at this Ford plant in Mexico, there are several leftist parties and groups organizing. One had been very successful, and that was the Revolutionary Workers' Party. They had really taken control of a local union in face of tremendous wage cuts from Ford. And they were mounting an election campaign which would have put them in charge of the Ford section of the CTM, of the Mexican Auto Workers Union. So the leaders of that were all fired a few weeks before that election, and then they began this Ford Workers Democratic Movement. So that really led up to the events that I read about. Ford, a mysterious group, kidnapped the leaders in early January. The workers did a work stoppage, did a sit-down strike, and their leaders were released. The following day, Ford had planned to fire the leaders who did the work stoppage on that Friday. And somehow this gang, which I believe was a CIA operation, and the gangster who led it, Wallace de la Mancha, was a CIA contract agent. And I think I am able to provide quite a bit of evidence for that in the book. They came in to stop a work stoppage Monday. The workers fought back successfully and occupied the plant for 2 weeks. Well, number one, they're concerned about their safety, and they had a bunch of very legitimate grievances they wanted settled. So it led to a two-week occupation of the plant. They were finally driven out by 2,000 police in mid-January, late January, and then there was still a strike that went on three or four more months before Ford got that back. Now, within this, the American I found documents that showed that Affeld and a guy I quite sure was a CIA agent, met with the head of the Mexican CTM Ford Union in 1988. I found documents that proved that Affeld had an office in the CTM building, and I got an embassy cable where they directly link Affeld people to the events that took place there. So then there's a big question of what exactly was Affeld, and so I spent several years researching that, and several chapters in the book are devoted to a history of the American Institute for Free Labor Development and what its relationship was to the CIA.
And so within that, what was the relationship of the AFL-CIO to this, and are there some major international unions in this country to these developments at that time?
That's a good question, because during the 60s, 70s, and 80s, Affeld appeared to be a branch of the AFL-CIO. They never clearly stated what their relationship was. The president of the AFL-CIO was the president of Affeld. The secretary-treasurer of the AFL-CIO was the secretary-treasurer of Affeld. They quite often allowed Affeld to speak on their behalf. During the 80s, when there were gaps in the funding for Affeld, the AFL-CIO paid for that. What I'm quite certain what it was a government agency managed by the CIA for which the AFL-CIO gladly provided cover throughout the Cold War.
So I continued to be aghast, not because some of this was not known, but your investigation, how is it that an organization that is presumably formed to be explicitly a champion of the working class becomes so perverse that it allies itself with, and indeed funds, really, it's a creation, Affeld of AFL-CIO. How is it that they partner with the CIA through this to destroy labor? I mean, what do you unearth that kind of rationalizes, or what is the ideology behind this so that we can really understand the problematic and this sordid history of this country and the imperialist country, which filtered down even to even, but used what should be the forces, the tools, the organizations of the working class against the working class?
The AFL was really a product of the Cold War, and the AFL-CIO was very committed to U.S. foreign policy. And, you know, in many ways, that was their main issue throughout the Cold War. They had worked with the CIA in the 1950s in Europe in the Free Trade Union Committee. So they were had their hand with the CIA in the creation of AFLD in 1962. And it was all about fighting the Cold War, the Soviet Union. But in that battle, in the chapters that I investigated, three of those, at least, they overthrew democratically elected governments. That would be at Brazil, Chile, British Guiana, were all democratically elected. And AFLD was involved in destabilizing all of those governments that led to coups and where they were replaced by military dictatorships. So, and they never batted an eye at George Meany and the AFL-CIO about that. That's, they thought those were all good things, and they were perfectly willing to defend those. Now, within the U.S. labor, there was always opposition to that. There were always people who supported international solidarity. So I try to trace that and show there were options to what was going on here, and there were people who did their best to try to change the direction of the AFL-CIO. Victor Reuther took him on. He was did an interview in 1966 with the Los Angeles Times where he linked AFLD, the AFL-CIO, and CIA. And it created a huge blow-up in labor and led to the UAW leaving the AFL-CIO in 1967. They stopped paying dues and were kicked out in 68. And they started forming a rival labor federation called the Alliance for Labor Action. And Victor said in an interview or an article in 1967 that I did my best to raise the lid on this, referring to the CIA. Someday it will all come out. Well, it didn't, because Walter Reuther's plane crashed and he died in 1970. And as much as I didn't want to look too hard at that, that was no question an assassination. And when I started this, I thought I knew a lot about the UAW. I did not know there was a mystery to Walter's death. But the National Transportation Safety Board found the altimeter had been sabotaged. The runway lights had been shut off just before they landed, so the pilot had to rely on the altimeter, which was reading 250 feet higher than the plane was. And that there are 200 pages of FBI documents about the crash that they wouldn't release on grounds of national security. So as much as I didn't want to wade into conspiratorial assassinations, I ended up there tracing the debate over AFLD. And I'd say the same thing happened in the 70s and even more so in the 80s. I mean, they finally, in the 80s, beat back some of the worst of this Cold War adventurism that the AFL-CIO had been involved in.
Now, AFLD was disbanded in the early 90s. But did the policies really change after that?
Well, it was abolished in 1996, along with the other institutes. There was an Asian American Free Labor Institute and African American Labor Center doing the same thing in those parts of the world. They were all abolished in 96, and a new organization was founded, which was called the Solidarity Center, International Labor Committee for Solidarity. I always thought, well, Sweeney came in and he saw these were bad and started a new organization. But my research uncovered that actually the Solidarity Center had been an initiative of Lane Kirkland and Tom Donahue. And that they had all, and I got an interview where Bill Doherty laid out the theoretical basis for what they needed to do now that the Cold War was over. And the Solidarity Center fell pretty closely in line with that. So my view is that, you know, there is still a government-funded labor front. And sometimes the State Department does the right thing. And sometimes Solidarity Center does the right thing. But it is a government-funded agency, a totally government-funded agency. So there was a break, but there's a continuation, too.
Well, we've got that whole middle piece. My mouth is still agape at, maybe I missed it, but I hadn't heard the accusation of assassination of Rutha. That is extraordinary. I want to just plow back into that. How did you begin to have access or uncover these documents? I mean, they're really monumental events in history and indictment of not just a field and the AFL-CIO, but it's an indictment of a whole country, which is really extraordinary. So tell us more about how you unearth these documents. And the fact of it is, where can we go with that today?
Well, you know, those are good questions. And some, I knew this was bigger. I mean, I'm not a labor historian or an academic. I really hesitated to follow this. But I was following the debate in labor over Affeld. And that led me to the end of that debate in the 60s, which was Ruther. And I was able to get a copy of the National Transportation Safety Board's accident report, which actually was very good. Victor Ruther, in his autobiography, summarizes a lot of that. I mean, Victor gave several interviews, which I was able to find. He thought it was an assassination. By the time the 90s came, he was convinced, and he would tell anyone who would listen, it was an assassination. And if you look at the Transportation Safety Board, they really did a great job of investigating this and analyzing the altimeter, which had a major part that had a loose screw, and then six other defects in an altimeter. The manufacturer of the altimeter, Colesman Instruments, they denied any responsibility. He said, we built this altimeter for the military. It was never even certified to be used in private aviation. We don't know how this altimeter got in the plane. So now we're getting into some details here. A Detroit news guy named Bill Gallagher did a Freedom of Information Act in the mid-80s, and he got hundreds of pages about Ruther. There's a lot that were denied him, including the 200 pages about the accident. So I just had a phone conversation with Bill a couple weeks ago, and he had donated his documents to an archive. So hopefully we'll be able to follow that up more. But what the impact of that was, when you had really the most progressive section of the U.S. labor movement under Ruther really fall apart after his death. I mean, there are big implications to that. And honestly, they're bigger than somebody like me can really tackle.
Well, since you're saying it's bigger than somebody like you, what's the potential for now really following through and reviving the interest and a real investigation of the what we're suggesting is the assassination of Rutha, a major labor leader, and in many ways the death at that moment, both of him and of progressive labor, which is what they were trying to kill. So where can we go with that? Because that's one of the things that I take from your book, that these should be cold cases that are revived, the investigations and the history set straight. And also, you know, that was just one of the things that you suggest. Also tell us some of the other incredibly deviant, destructive activity of the CIA through its relationship with Affeld.
Well, I mean, I think if you look at Chile, I worked with a graduate student from Cambridge who I met while he was doing research on the Allende coup in Chile. And he did Affeld. I mean, there was a lot of declassified CIA documents about the Chile coup, nothing about Affeld. I never found anything. And he did a lot of original research about Affeld's involvement in that bloody, horrible coup in Chile. And again, I think that's a place where you can look at what happened. It not only was a disaster for Chile, but it became a testing ground for a lot of the new ideas about hyper-competitive free market capitalism and monetarism. They had started a program with something like that in the University of Chicago, and a lot of the graduates went to Chile and started using some of these new programs, which really came back to the U.S. in the form of free trade agreements, which were devastating to manufacturing. Deregulation, which really hurt the building and construction trades. They're always fighting, trying to hold on to prevailing wage. And privatization, which has hurt the public sector. So, again, I don't know if anybody had that plan when they started the coup in Chile, but it really has come back to haunt us here in the U.S. and the U.S. labor movement. Brazil was another early coup, too, the head of that country was a democratically elected guy who I would put more in the non-aligned camp. He was actually a millionaire rancher who ran for the Labor Party. And Affeld was very involved in that coup, and there's proof of that. That was a bloody military dictatorship where a lot of unionists end up being arrested, tortured, and some executed. So there's a really sad history with Affeld and the CIA involvement in labor that has not only hurt the countries they were carrying these things out in, but has hurt U.S. labor too.
Bring us up to date on what happened in Mexico after the incident, the dreadful incident that you outlined with the shootings of the 9 union workers there.
There's really been a lot of changes in the last year in the situation there. When I first started researching in Mexico, I was able to get in touch with a labor activist in Mexico who gave me a lot of help. But one email I got from him, he said, well, this weekend I was involved in the founding of a new labor federation called Centia, and we're going to focus on organizing auto workers. And I said, well, I hope they have some success challenging that CTM and the government pro-government union. And some of your listeners may be aware, I'm sure you are, that there was a big election at General Motors Silao a couple months ago, and the Centia, this independent union, won an overwhelming victory at a huge plant. And a couple weeks ago, they won an election at a big parts plant in Matamoros. So they're having great success there. And one of the leaders of the dissidents at Ford Cuautitlan is an advisor for Centia. So I could not be happier for their success. And I think one of the things that is just an amazing change is the AFL-CIO came out and in favor of a fair election there they put out. Well, that means they're supporting the independent union if they have to go on record for a fair election. The Biden administration came out and urging a fair election at GM Silao. U.S. Trade Rep followed suit. And the Solidarity Center has been active in support of this new labor federation. So I would say government policy, and these were the same forces that were arrayed against these dissidents in Mexico, along with the conservative forces in Mexico. So that is really a major change. And I think government policy has changed. They've realized that the super low wage pool of labor on the border has had destabilizing political effect in the U.S., which it has. So today I was on Twitter and I saw that Labor Notes, I'm sure you guys are familiar with that, has posted a link where you can contribute directly to Centia through the Act Blue charity. And, if people are concerned about low wages and lack of union rights in Mexico and they're able to do it, this is a good place to donate some money. I donated some money to them today.
And you're absolutely right. And Labor Notes is a wonderful, wonderful organization. Rob McKenzie, I'm interested in following through on the other kinds of influence that Affeld had while they were operating, as indicated, in Brazil, in Chile, and, in Mexico, and were hand in glove with the CIA. Talk about also some of the other policies that may have been effectuated, perhaps the evolution of NAFTA and other extremely destructive trade agreements that may have grown out of these imperialist policies that were being exercised by the labor arm, if you will, AFIEL, the labor arm of the CIA. How did it also impact further the policies and practices that affected the working class here?
Well, and I think you mentioned NAFTA, and of course that was a huge one. After the election, the 1988 election, within weeks, the U.S. government, the Bush administration, Reagan administration, sent to Mexico a new diplomatic team, and that included John D. Negroponte. I'm not sure if you know who he is. He was in Honduras working in support of the Contras against Nicaragua. That was one of his main roles, alleged by the press. He had a deputy chief of mission there, a guy called Robert Pastorino, who also went to Mexico within weeks. Pastorino had been in Honduras, he'd been in the National Security Council for Reagan in charge of Latin America. So when those two got to Mexico, Pastorino wrote the first conceptual draft of NAFTA. Negroponte, who became director of national intelligence in 2005, the first, said his greatest accomplishment in Mexico was facilitating negotiations between Bush and Salinas for the NAFTA agreement. So here you see a direct link between the national security community and NAFTA. And these dissidents in Cuautitlan in Mexico were opposed to NAFTA because they thought it turned over too much control of the Mexican economy to U.S. corporations. And we had allies in fighting NAFTA there, but we actually, the AFL-CIO and the CIA participated in silencing them and getting them fired and putting an end to that movement. So, I mean, in my generation, NAFTA had a huge effect. I mean, we saw tens of thousands of factories close, and we saw really a wave of deunionization in the United States. So these are big issues, and they really need to be studied more.
Well, where do you think we are today? Why is this so important to understand at this time? There are certainly the concrete things that you detail so beautifully in your book, El Golpe, U.S. Labor, the CIA, and the Coup at Ford in Mexico. But ideologically, why is it still so important to have a shovel to dig deep and dig away the dirt of this subversion by American institutions of progressive worker organizations?
Well, you know, I ran into a lot of resistance in trying to research this. I mean, a lot of people in labor, and I was a union president for 9 years and a national staff person for 10 years. Do not want to talk about this. Nobody's proud of it at this point. They want to keep it covered up, and they want to keep it in the past. But from what I've seen in labor, that when you do that, nothing gets acknowledged, nothing gets accounted for, nobody is assigned responsibility, and nothing gets changed. And so in order to progress, we have to take a hard, cold look at what happened here and make sure that it never happens again, and that we have a lot of agreement on the necessity of international solidarity with other workers.
And Rob McKenzie, take us out with another passage from El Golpe, U.S. Labor, the CIA, and the Coup at Ford in Mexico.
Okay, I've got one here now that's really in the conclusion. So we had talked a lot about the CIA, and I kind of write a little about what my final thoughts are on this. The AFL-CIO enmeshed itself with a vast government-funded foreign policy bureaucracy throughout the Cold War. Some of the government agents employed in the field collected intelligence information about American unions. Others participated in unions' internal decision-making and helped direct its policy. The irony of a labor organization, such as the American Institute for Free Labor Development, which defined itself in terms of the struggle for free labor in opposition to those labor organizations that were government controlled, being run by government agents, was undoubtedly not lost on U.S. adversaries. The Cold War led to a complete victory for the forces supporting neoliberal capitalism. In contrast, unionization rates in the U.S. as a percentage of the workforce peaked in 1955 at 33%. In 1962, the year AFLD was founded, that figure stood at 29.3%. Union membership in terms of absolute numbers reached its zenith in 1979, the year Lane Kirkland became AFL president.
I think your pup seemed to like that.
Yeah, she really doesn't think I should be in here reading.
Dogs of war.
The dogs of war indeed, Ken. Well, just finally then, Rob McKenzie, there's the issue of accountability, or is there the issue of accountability and the issue of the lesson, the takeaway to learn from this? While you've already mentioned in response to Ken that there are some transformative things that have taken place, are there really, or is the takeaway that there is still a deep-rooted conservatism, or worse, that would destroy the progressive movements of labor of the working class wherever they sprout up? What do you want us to take away? And again, the question of accountability in the brief amount of time that we have left.
Well, you know, the AFL-CIO and its affiliate unions certainly have the power to make the changes that we need to have made. I mean, I'm proposing three things. One is they open up all the International Affairs Department files and the AFLD files that are in the archives. They are closed. Some of them are over 50 years old, still closed. But the AFL established a commission to investigate exactly what did happen during the Cold War and report back to the affiliate unions. There's a lot of questions that we didn't have time to get in here, including about some of the leaders of the AFL-CIO. And the thing that they could do quickly and easily to show that they're ready to make a change is to, there's a Kirkland Meaney Human Rights Award they give out annually. This is a mockery of history. Any objective reading of history shows that to be the case. There's hundreds, if not thousands, of dedicated unionists who spent their lives trying to improve international human rights, that award would be better named after. So those are things I think that the AFL-CIO can do to move away from this past.
Well, the other thing we can all do is read El Golpe, U.S. Labor, the CIA, and the Coup at Ford in Mexico, Rob McKenzie with Patrick Dunn. And then we need to get on board and support the continuing work, because Rob McKenzie is an activist. And this isn't an academic study. It's an activist study to further the interests of the working class nationwide, indeed around the world, and to make sure that progressive labor organization is not subverted by the right. And we thank you for the work that you do, for your commitment. And I guess there's some good reasons to retire. It certainly gives an awful lot of time to investigate these really critical issues.
You're working hard during your retirement.
It was a labor of love.
That's quite obvious. Thank you so much. And we're going to follow through on this. We've got to keep this connection between us, because we're about building bridges and we're about building movements.
Well, thank you so much for having me on.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure. And we have been speaking with Rob McKenzie again. El Golpe, U.S. Labor, the CIA, and the Coup at Ford in Mexico. And let's hear a little bit about what Sweet Honey in the Rock has to say now about, I think it takes more than a paycheck.
We bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and families. We bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and families. We bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and families. More than a paycheck to our loved ones and families. We bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and families. We bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and families. I wanted more. But what I've got here today is more than I bargained for.
Well, it certainly does take more than a paycheck, and that's to some degree what our next section is about, right, Ken?
Hey, Mimi, isn't pay equity a fundamental feminist issue? I mean, on average, full-time working women earn just 82 cents for every dollar a man earns. The significant gap is more than a statistic. It is the real-life consequences that it stands for.
Well, Ken, let's put that question to Elise Gould, senior economist at the Economic Policy Institute, whose areas of research include wages, poverty, inequality, economic mobility, and health care. It's particularly good to have you with us during Women's History Month, shortly after Pay Equity Day and International Working Women's Day. And good gracious, Elise, 2022, what's the skinny on the issues of the disparity in wages between men and women? And it's, again, so good to have you with us.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me. Well, we know that there is a large gap, and there is a large gap between men and women in terms of their labor market opportunities, namely their wages, oftentimes other benefits and working conditions go along with that. But talking about just simply pay, there is a large gap, and it cannot be explained away no matter how you measure it. So you mentioned measuring it on for full-time workers. If you measure it on an hourly basis, if you look at how much people make in a given week, there is a big gap. If you look at things like when we economists, we talk about, well, let's control for what kind of job you have or what kind of industry you work in or where you live in the country or how old you are or whether or not you're a parent. All of those things, how much education you have, no matter what you control for, there is still a gap left over that is significant and has not really narrowed in the last few decades.
You mentioned in your article in the Economic Policy Institute in your study that even in certain sectors, like, for instance, education, where women have moved over to that area to get better-paying jobs. But indeed, no matter how many degrees women get, PhDs and so on and so forth, men who have just BAs get paid more. What's up?
That's right. On average, that is absolutely right. So let's just back up a second. So we think about who has higher education in this country. Actually, women have now exceeded the number of men with college degrees or advanced degrees. And yet, when you look at what it is that they get returns to that additional investment, those years, the money, the resources that pour into that, they're not getting the same return that men do. And so women has a graduate degree, on average, they're still being paid less than a man with just a college degree. It's a stark comparison, I think.
And how does this translate, because how couldn't it, to the discrepancy between particular women of color, and what they make as against white women, what they make against certainly men?
Yes, it's certainly true that when you look at the gender wage gap, you're only seeing part of the story. There's huge inequities between black and white workers. Again, there we have not seen much progress in the last few decades. The gaps between Hispanic and white workers have seen a little bit more progress, but there's still a stubborn gap that remains. between white and Hispanic workers. But then if you have the look at the intersectional picture, looking at both gender and race or ethnicity together, there are much larger gaps that black and Hispanic women face compared to their white non-Hispanic counterparts. So it is a stubborn and very large and persistent wage gap, so that when you're paid so much less on an hourly basis, that is thousands of dollars every year. And when that adds up over your lifetime, I mean, it is an incredibly significant difference.
Well, I mean, Dr. King was talking about this stuff in 1968 before his assassination. He was talking about the color line. And here we are talking about it more than 50 years later. What is in the arsenal of, the federal government, for instance, the EEOC, the Equal Employment Opportunities Commission? Is that a place to start looking for a solution?
It's definitely one of the things that I would be looking at. I mean, I think when we think about the gender inequities and we think about racial and ethnic pay gaps, there is no silver bullet. There is no silver bullet to solving pay equity, but there's rather a menu of policy options that can close both of those gaps. I mean, I think we have to think about many different policies. Absolutely, thinking about what the Equal Employment and Opportunity Commission can do. So you want to make sure that you're staffing and funding those kinds of agencies that are charged with enforcement of non-discrimination laws. One of the things that we can also do is increase federal reporting of pay by gender, race, and ethnicity. So making that information more accessible to people, prohibiting employers from asking about pay history, that's one of the things that some cities have been trying to enforce, because then every time you get a new job, you think maybe you have a new opportunity. When the employer finds out your pay history, it just perpetuates the discrimination that you've already experienced. Some cities and states are looking at requiring employers to post pay bands when hiring, so that the employer says, this is the range in which I'm going to pay for this job. Depending on how much education and experience, you're going to be different places in this range. And when they're much more explicit about that, then there's less discretion in terms of paying candidates wildly different amounts for the same job.
Elise Gould, I want to backtrack a bit before we get to what is to be done. And I just want to, many of us have thought, well, you know, you can close the wage gap by getting more education, or women can close the wage gap by choosing different occupations. Is that true, or is it even worse than I realize? And then, of course, we should talk about what the consequences of this gap are, because to some people it may seem, it's de minimis, it's not all that significant, but it darn well is. So can we better the situation by getting more degrees, by shifting occupations, or is it really kind of across the board?
Well, I think in a lot of ways it's across the board, right? So there's not one single thing that we can think of that's going to solve this, but I think we could think about the different avenues. So you're right. More education in general leads to higher wages on average. That's true. You make those investments, you're more likely to be able to get a better job, not only with better pay, maybe more autonomy, better benefits, maybe more flexible hours. Maybe you would have been lucky to be able to work from home during the pandemic, right? All of those things come with more education. It's also costly to have that additional education. But then you see that the returns to education aren't the same. So how much that translates into better pay is just not the same for women as men. And so that is not the only answer, because by last year's data, women's educational attainment had surpassed men's educational attainment. And so you saw that while about 37% of men had a college degree, it was almost 44% of women. And so that is not the answer on its own. You also mentioned occupational segregation. So that's the likelihood of women being in different kinds of jobs than men, right? Historical discrimination, all sorts of messages that society gives to girls about going into certain fields that leads to women being in certain fields that are lower paying on average. And in fact, when women enter certain fields, pay may actually decline because they're undervalued in the labor market.
I want to ask about what kind of teeth certain federal agencies have to rectify this. Now, you talked about the EEOC, but it can bring lawsuits, but that takes years and a lot of money to do those. Can fines be levied? What can the federal government or state government, local government do to rectify the situation?
I think another avenue to go is to think about what are the where is it that the pay gap is actually smaller and what has been effective in doing that. So we think about things like the minimum wage, and the minimum wage provides a wage floor, and we know that the federal minimum wage has not been raised in many years, but many states have increased their minimum. And what that does and what the effect of that is that there's actually a smaller wage gap for lower wage workers between men and women. And that's because you have that minimum wage that is setting this standard so that you can't pay anyone below that amount. So that's one way to think about it. Another way to think about what you can do is places that you see smaller wage gaps are oftentimes in the public sector where there's less room for discrimination, where you have more pay transparency and you have those kind of pay bands that I was talking about before, where you have a scale that you pay people and they fit on the scale based on their experience and education, and there's less discretion to pay people different amounts. Another thing the federal government can do, they can make it easier for workers to form unions and bargain collectively. And in those kinds of contracts, you're also going to see smaller pay gaps because of how salaries are laid out in their contracts.
You know, two of the other things that concern me, because I'm not sure that people fully understand or even say, gee, what the federal government should do. I'm not sure they understand the consequences of this. Very often they'll hear a statistic that, well, I don't know, you're making 83 cents on a dollar. But the consequences, tell us about what it really means. And that's without us even discussing whether women also go through significant issues with a quote-unquote motherhood penalty and so on. So talk about what it means to actually be earning less on the dollar. It's an ideological issue, surely. It's a political issue. It's an issue of pride and dignity. But concretely, what does it mean for people to be able to live?
Right. I mean, it's absolutely all of those issues, and it's an economic security issue. You simply can't afford, maybe in some cases, you can't afford the basic necessities because you simply are not paid enough to be able to afford them. And you don't have the same independence. You don't have the same ability to make ends meet, to support your family. These are huge consequences to be able to retire with some kind of dignity and security. All of those add up over the years to be a very significant difference. I think one of the things that we think about a lot in terms of the motherhood penalty is that is not only that mothers, on average, are paid less, maybe have less opportunities after they have a child, the gap between fathers and mothers actually grows. Fathers are seen to be more committed to their job because they have to support a family. And when a woman is going to become a mother, oftentimes they're seen as less committed to their job and maybe less likely to get those promotions. And so it just perpetuates itself. And so we think about policies that will help parents, let's say, that will also reduce the gender pay gap. So if you have policies like paid parental leave, it's not only important that women are able to take that kind of leave, but also for men. And to show that practice in the workplace, that can also help with the division of labor at home.
So women are catching up. We're in 2022. They're returning to the workforce. They're going to do better. We're going to shrink that wage gap. Oh, please say yes, but not quite, huh?
I'm not so optimistic. I mean, what we've learned in the pandemic is that a lot of these issues were magnified, right? We saw childcare closing, schools A lot of kids were going to school from home. That put strain on families, on parents, and disproportionately women, mothers, bore that burden. But that's not a new problem. We've seen in this country over the last 20 years, we have not seen the kind of increases in participation in the labor market in the United States that we've seen in some of our peer countries, countries that have better child care policies, better parental leave policies, better work supports for families, for women to be able to stay in the labor market. And so we're not seeing many gains here in terms of participation, and we're certainly not seeing gains in closing the gender pay gap.
So, Elise, piggybacking on Ken's discussion, is the focus that we should have on the federal government, is the focus expanding unions where perhaps there should be harder and more aggressive bargaining and more likelihood that there would be for people who are unionized to deal with this terrible disparity, this wage parity gap? I mean, Ken already asked it, and let's continue that. So what is to be done?
Yeah, I would say yes, all of those things. We need to take it at all the levels we can. I mean, I think there can be local, state, and federal policymakers that take this head on and try to figure out how to narrow these gaps. So some of the things are specific to making sure that that women and Black and Hispanic workers have the same opportunities as their male and white counterparts. Making sure that we are enforcing the laws, but also making sure we have stronger labor standards. As you said, make it easier for workers to form unions. Make pay more transparent so people understand what those gaps look like so they can do something about it. And employers can take a hard look at what it is that they're paying their workers and make sure that they're providing not only the same pay for people doing the same position, but also more equality in terms of opportunities for promotion. I think all of those things are things that should be taken a look at.
Well, EPI has done a lot of studies both on this and with regard to the racial pay gap, and their website is www.epi.org. Where else can people get information?
Absolutely. On our website, we have information on the different policies. We also have a lot of data where you can look and see for yourself what the different gaps look like at different parts of the wage distribution for people of different education. And so you can go to our data library there, epi.org/data, and learn more about that.
Do you also think that the quote-unquote feminist movement, writ large, understands the fundamentality, the essentiality of taking up this issue, that it is a fundamental issue, that women are poorer and as a result of deliberate policies? So in the last minute, particularly because this is Women's History Month and because we just passed International Working Women's Day and Pay Equity Day, your thought in the last minute about the politics of this and people taking it up as a fundamental issue?
Well, I think it's important across the board. I think it's important that we run our labor market, a strong labor market, to give opportunities for people who have been historically disadvantaged in getting the, and they need to get those opportunities. So I do think we need to be thinking about that holistically and form coalitions across many different groups that have experienced this kind of discrimination at the hands of employers.
Well, Elise Gould, thank you for the work you do with EPI. People should check out their website. It's chock full of really important data. And since you started with Martin Luther King, Ken, I'm going to go back, and we realize that the issue of civil rights is joined with human rights, and that must be joined with economic rights to
Absolutely.
Remedy discrimination. And Elise Gould, thank you again for being our guest. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash. We're Building Bridges.
And we always say educate, agitate, and organize to empower we the people for another world is possible if we choose to work to make it so. Thank you for listening.
bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and families. We bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and families. We bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and families. More than a paycheck to our loved ones and families. We bring more than